The headlines: Hamas says Israeli home demolitions will encourage Palestinians to fight to get back every inch of their land as the military blows up the house of a prisoner. President Biden announces a new military aid package for Ukraine worth $150 million. Plus, North Korea fires what its neighbors say was a ballistic missile as the U.S. warns an imminent nuclear test is on the cards. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmati and these are our top stories this hour. Israeli forces have attacked a group of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. A young man was injured and rushed to hospital. The Palestinians were angry at the destruction of the home of a prisoner in Jenin. Omar Jaradat was detained in December last year on charges of involvement in an operation that left an Israeli dead. Recently, an Israeli court ordered the demolition to go ahead. A senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the move. Azat Arashka said that Israeli insistence on continuing its crimes will not bring security to its regions. He warned that the demolition of homes will only enhance the determination of Palestinians to resist the occupier and get back every inch of their land. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has denounced Israel's repeated attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian worshippers, blaming the intensifying violence on normalization with the regime. Saeed Khatibzadeh called on the Islamic countries to maintain unity to defend Palestinian and Al-Aqsa. That is the third holiest site to Muslims. Khatibzadeh said occupiers are now declining, adding that the Palestinian people have the legitimate right to fight Israel's occupation of their land. He called on regional countries and the international community to help Palestinians in their fight. Over the past few weeks, Israeli forces have on various occasions attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and the occupied Al-Quds. Hundreds have been injured as a result. Palestinians in return have stepped up retaliatory attacks against Israelis. And the Israeli regime has launched a massive manhunt for the Palestinians behind an attack in the Israeli city of Elad. The operation has also far drawn strong support from Palestinian resistance movements and threats from Israelis. However, no group has yet claimed responsibility for what many are calling a, quote, heroic act.
Two Palestinians have carried out a retaliatory operation in the central Israeli city of Elad, where several casualties were reported. The operation came hours after Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for hundreds of settlers to enter the holy site in Al-Quds. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured and many more arrested in the raid on Thursday. The retaliation also coincides with the Nakba, the anniversary of the illegal creation of Israel. Palestinian resistance movements have praised the operation as a natural response to Israeli crimes.
Operation Elad is part of the public display of our people's anger at the invasion of our sanctuaries by the occupiers. Today's operation goes in line with the resistance's warning that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line.
We hail the successful and heroic operation in occupied Al-Quds and remind Israel that our people will respond to the regime's crimes.
President Mahmoud Abbas, however, condemned the operation and warned against the Israelis making this incident a pretext to target the Palestinians. The operation comes against the backdrop of the regime's intensified acts of violence across the occupied West Bank, including targeting Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa. Over the past weeks, tensions have been running high at the mosque compound due to incursions by Israeli settlers protected by regime forces. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the latest attacks. Dozens have been arrested.
An occupying force cannot continuously trample on the rights of the subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, basically wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
As a consequence of Israel's atrocities, the Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities. An Israeli minister has said the regime suffered a very heavy price in the Elad operation. And now Israel has once again revved up its crackdown machine against the Palestinians through arresting dozens of people and closing the crossings to the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip, actions that will undoubtedly escalate the already tense circumstances in the occupied territories.
Russia says it has no intention of using nuclear weapons in the war with Ukraine. The foreign ministry slams as, quote, deliberate lies, reports by Western media suggesting the possibility of a nuclear strike by Moscow.
As I have already said, we have repeatedly had to refute insinuations about Russia's possible use of nuclear weapons in the course of its special military operation in Ukraine. This is a deliberate lie. Russia firmly adheres to the principle that there can be no winners in a nuclear war.
Zaitsev said Russia's use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine is ruled out since it is not in line with the objectives of its military operation there. Russia's ambassador to Washington has also reacted to the Western accusations. Anatoly Antonov says such, quote, baseless allegations are part of a propaganda campaign against Russia. The diplomat also accused the West of misinterpreting Moscow's recent decision to place its nuclear forces on high alert. He said the move was in response to extremely confrontational statements by Western countries that possess nuclear weapons. The United States has announced a new weapons package worth $150 million for Ukraine to use in its war with Russia. President Joe Biden said the package will provide additional artillery munitions, radars, and other equipment. The U.S. had already sent more than $3.4 billion worth of weaponry to Ukraine. Biden has warned that the current funding is running out and urged Congress to authorize more. He wants the chamber to authorize a huge $33 billion Ukraine package that includes $20 billion in military aid. The U.S. and its allies continue to supply arms to Ukraine despite repeated warnings by Russia to stop that. Moscow has warned of unpredictable consequences if Ukraine gets more weapons. Journalist and political commentator Dmitry Zolotarev says the U.S. is helping its own manufacturers by supplying weapons to Ukraine.
Russia emphasized that it has to save as many civilian population of Ukraine as possible. And the slow moving of Russian army through Ukraine is explained only by that. Because if Russia followed the United States or Great Britain or NATO, should I say NATO rules, it would shell the whole territory of Ukraine, glass it flat, and the whole war would be over in a couple of days, like I said long before. So sending the crew weapons to Ukraine is only about making lots of profit to the United States and about the deterioration of economic situation inside the United States. And Biden administration is trying hard to create the situation of military contracts inside the United States to increase the military plans to supply more weapons.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Japan and South Korea say the North has fired a ballistic missile into the sea off its coast. Southern Korean military believes that the projectile was a short-range submarine-launched missile. On Wednesday, both countries also said North Korea had fired a ballistic missile. Pyongyang has not commented on both launches, but in recent weeks it has announced plans to build up its arsenal and even spoke of a preemptive nuclear strike to counter hostile forces. The North says its nuclear and missile program is for self-defense against U.S.-led threats in the region. Washington has recently assessed that Pyongyang could be ready to conduct a nuclear test as early as this month. To discuss that further, we're joined by Andrew Leung, independent China specialist, who's joining us live from Hong Kong, and also Emmanuel Pasrich, president of the Asia Institute from Seoul. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Leung. What, in your opinion, is prompting North Korea to speed up its ballistic missile tests in recent weeks? Does it have anything to do with the war in Ukraine and Pyongyang's concerns about a future military conflict in Asia?
Well, there are several aspects to this. First of all, there is no doubt that Kim Jong-un is entirely fed up with so-called negotiations with the United States because the U.S. is seen to be unable or unwilling for any sort of compromise, always insisting on North Korea giving up all its defenses before they could even consider some sort of a compromise. So I think that the Kim Jong-un is completely fed up with that and likely to begin any negotiations with the United States anytime soon. Secondly, Kim Jong-un is learning, taking a leaf from President Putin's book over Ukraine, because the possession of nuclear weapons is an effective deterrent to any direct military confrontation. So to guard against its own national security, North Koreans are embarking on possession of nuclear weapons together with its advanced delivering systems, so they're able to not to be coerced by the United States. I think that this also raises a third very important global dimension, which is that the United States can no longer call the shots in all circumstances, whether it's Ukraine with a direct kind of military confrontation or other areas like in Asia over North Korea, because the United States is increasingly exposing its hypocrisy, so-called U.S.-led liberal order, because it's neither liberal when it chooses to, as regards to its immigrants. It is also selective in the embracing of authoritative regimes, embracing some, but also sanctioning others. Thirdly, it is not immune from using dirty or hypocritic coercive measures for unilateral for the selfish gains. So I think that there is a gradual erosion of the credibility of the U.S.-led liberal order, that the United States is seen to be able to dictate what kind of ideology, what kind of rules the rest of the world should follow. Also, there's another dimension that the United States, in terms of population, even together with its Western allies in Europe, only accounts for 8% of the world's population. So I think that most of the world, including the developing world, do not see why the whole world order should just follow a one-size-fits-all formula dictated by only a small minority of the world. So I think that the North Koreans are seeing through all this and its intent to developing its own deterrence, even including nuclear weapons, to gain back its control over its own sovereignty and national defense.
Okay, so Mr. Pasrich, we just heard Mr. Leung's explanations. How likely do you think North Korea is to conduct a nuclear test soon? We've heard the United States warning that Pyongyang is preparing for an underground test this month.
Right. Well, I don't have sufficient information, and I'm not a fortune teller, so I can't give a percentage. However, I would say based on what happened before, some 7 years ago, that it's entirely possible, and there are certain incentives to conduct a nuclear test. First, the United States, as Dr. Leung had suggested, is in a particularly difficult situation, especially both globally and also specifically in, with Ukraine in the confrontation with Russia. So it's not really in a position to attack North Korea or even to really threaten any further North Korea. Moreover, and this is the more, I say, the more dangerous part, is there's an incentive for North Korea's development of weapons, of these submarine-launched intercontinental ballistic missiles and other new technology. Is part of a larger arms race in Asia, which simplistically you could say, well, it's the U.S. and its allies versus North Korea and China, but this is obviously not the case. All these countries from Indonesia and South Korea, Vietnam, China, North Korea, Japan, etc., are all building up their militaries, and there's extremely high danger that this regional arms race will spin out of control. So I think the risk of a test is high, but it's not 100%, and that we really need to start thinking seriously about real solutions. And the only real solution is arms control treaties and disarmament treaties.
Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Sri Lankan protesters are back on the streets in the capital, Colombo, in defiance of a state of emergency, calling on their government to step down. The protesters gathered outside President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's office and the residence of his brother, who is the prime minister. They blame the government for a worsening economic crisis that has caused food, fuel, and medicine shortages. Similar protests took place outside Parliament on Friday when police used tear gas to disperse the crowds. Also on Friday, Sri Lankans staged a nationwide strike that brought the country to a standstill. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
Such as gold.
Kingai.
Kingo.
Gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
El oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Five 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus, This is bezant, the best currency. The bezant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The bezant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500, well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a thousand year coin, if you like.
The bezant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the bezant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the bezant survived for 1,000 years. The bezant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you're a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins, backed by the government, played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. the price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, we are going to talk about a Muslim personality or personality in general. there are debates around personality, whether personality is shaped by nature or by nurture. So the controversy has been going on for a long time, of course, and the debate over whether the strengths and weaknesses of people are the results of nature or nurture has and somewhat continues to rage on between scholars and lay people alike, you know. A lot of people still keep wondering whether we can do anything to shape the personality or the character of our children or not. So this debate has had its significant social implications, particularly concerning what is thought to determine people's ability to learn. Now, when it comes to personality, many people define personality as the combination of characteristics or qualities that form an individual's distinctive character. And also, personality has been defined as a person's usual manner or style of behavior. So this is personality. But how is this personality created? How is this usual manner or style of behavior created? Is it created by nature, through genes, or is it created by the environment? Now, this can be very important in terms of religion also. Of course, this topic is usually discussed either in biology or discussed in psychology, but of course, there Islam, in the Quran, and also the prophetic tradition has also a say in this regard. For example, let's say that the Quran says you should not eat haram food. You should avoid eating things which are harmful. And for example, a pregnant woman is advised to eat lawful things. For example, things which are obtained through lawful means. She should eat, for example, fruit a lot. And of course, this has something to do with the nature, you know. When, for example, a woman is honest, her child is also going to be honest. When the parents of a child are honest, then the child is also going to be honest. There are some people who believe that the genes also have very important role to play in shaping a child's personality. But when it comes to the environment, of course, no one denies the impact of environment as well. When it comes to a child's personality and the patterns of behavior, these patterns of behavior tend to be predictable throughout a person's lifetime. Some people are introverts, we can see, others are extroverts. Some people are, you know, easygoing. Some people are the opposite, vice versa. Some people are cheerful, others are calm, and some people are optimistic, others are pessimistic, and some people are able to cope with the life's difficulties without much trouble. You know, their emotions are usually under control. They don't get extremely angry about little things. The other end of the personality spectrum are more emotional, experiencing higher highs and lower lows, of course. And most people's personalities, however, don't fall at the extreme ends, but rather fall somewhere in between, of course. They are not at the either side of the extreme. So most people, as we can see, are in between. So the question remains, where do we get our personality? Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
For hundreds of years, psychologists and ordinary people, scholars, Muslim scholars, exegetes of the Quran, the scholars of ethics, have never stopped debating this fascinating question. Some people, of course, think personality develops as a result of the environment, the combination of influences that we learn from, such as our families, our culture, our friends, and our education. And the people who believe this theory believe that all babies are born without a personality and that it is the environment that determines or forms each child's personality. And this school of thought is called the nurture school because they believe in the instrumentality of the environment. They believe that the environment is highly effective and that no one can influence, no one can prevent, no one can avoid the influence of the environment. And of course, they also believe that babies are born without a personality. We find people who believe that personality is determined by nature or the characteristics we receive or inherit from our parents biologically through their genes. These people believe that our personality is not determined by the environment, but rather by genetics, and that each baby is born with a personality. And remember that every individual is born by a personality. This is also a theory on the other side or at the end of the continuum. The nature-nurture controversy is very old. And of course, as I said, this question has been debated for centuries, for decades, for centuries, and from time immemorial. And of course, scholars have tried to discover which of these two factors, genes or genetics or the environment, is more important in forming our personality. However, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to conduct research on real people with real lives because you cannot test people in the external world. There is just no way to put people, you know, in laboratory and keep watching them. This is not possible. And it's not possible to watch people in a laboratory, how they develop and how their character is built and how their personality is developed. That's not possible practically. For this reason, there is no way, there is no scientific way to settle the nature and nurture controversy. And of course, most researchers have recently come to believe that both the environment and the genes, nurture and nature, work together and are both important. So this is, I think, the best opinion, and also based on the traditions that we have received from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and also the Quranic verses, the genes, the genetics, and also the environment are both very much instrumental. They are working together to build a person's personality. There's a tradition that says that if a person does kindness to his parents, then he will live longer. If a person gives charity, he will live longer. This is the effect of charity. And this has nothing to do with genetics. And if a person, for example, lives in a bad environment, he will end up becoming bad. If, for example, a girl lives in a bad family, even the religion says not to approach that girl's family for marriage. A man is discouraged to seek that girl's hand in marriage to himself because she was born in a bad family and she grew up in a bad family, and bad family was the environment in which she grew up. That's all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.